tape number 6 of this series on the underlying spiritual meaning of world civilization. Gordon Brown.
From where we left off then at the end of tape 5, somewhere in the middle, wasn't it, of this colossal 6,000-year period, correlative with the 6th day of creation and with the 6th synonym in the fundamental divine order, truth. The term truth having the same signification, hasn't it, as the term Christ, showing why the 6th day is all about the fullness of man in the image and likeness of God, who is given dominion over all the earth. Man in and of Christ, truth that is. And it also explains why, in accordance with the exegesis of the 6th day of creation in science and health, the 6th day itself requires the full sevenfold range of truth in its aspects as mind, as spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, whereby to express itself. Now, of course, we're happy about that, aren't we? And we'd reached the point on tape 5, you remember, of the 5th of these reflecting tones, truth in its aspect as life, where in the period's actual historicity shown in the civilization column of the triptych, the enormously important event was taking place of where England's 13 original American colonies were in process of demanding an independent life of their own, and were fighting, therefore, their war of independence against the restrictions imposed on them by a repressive mother country. And we noted how, in the course of this so-called American Revolution, Thomas Jefferson, in company with a number of his fellow colonialists, was largely responsible for drawing up the document known as the Declaration of Independence, with its famous lines about all men being created equal and about God having endowed them with the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So that when in 1783 the colonies emerged victorious, a new American nation began its triumphant God-appointed march onto the world scene. Yet before the new nation, made up now of 13 separate states, could fully establish its nationhood, it had to endure the horrors of a long and bitter civil war. A contest, that is, between northern states wanting complete federal union and southern states wanting to stay separate and retain their independence. Well, finally, in 1865, it was the Union that was at last victorious, and all the states, north and south, found themselves welded into a single democratized republic. And thus there was born into the world the nation of the United States of America, destined to become the leading nation of the whole Western world. And it's at this point, therefore, that we continue now with the story itself, because this crucial American Union did not in fact take place historically until Western society as a whole had virtually drawn the entire civilized world into its own physical science net and in that sense had made the world itself one unified world, signifying that its physical science technologies had symbolically unified mankind in preparation for the second Christly advent, the coming of the world's actual all-encompassing divine science, parallel with the way in which in the closing stages of the fourth period, the Roman Empire had unified the world under the personal God-King Caesar in preparation for the first Christly advent, the coming of the person of the man Christ Jesus. All of which means that the stage is now set for us to enter upon the sixth tone of the sixth period, truth, purely as truth, which because of what this tone holds spiritually and redemptively regarding the human race as a whole, is the event we now see that civilization has been waiting for and leading up to ever since the movement launched itself historically some 6,000 years before. Because the almighty point to realize now is that spiritually understood, the Christian Science movement and the civilization movement, ultimating in the movement of the city or civilization that lieth foursquare, are, when analyzed and understood metaphysically, one and the same God-impelled movement, namely, that of the Spirit of God moving on the face of world consciousness in Genesis 1-2 and launching the 7 days of creation as the order of its own unfoldment, at the same time as it eliminates from the consciousness of humanity the time scale of the 7,000-year periods. Now, can we be happy about that and begin to appreciate its simple holistic meaning? In other words, the movement of the Spirit of God has down the ages been underlying and determining the movement of civilization itself until at last the reality of God's ever-presence comes fully to the surface of consciousness in the form of the Christian Science movement. When this is spiritually and scientifically evaluated and understood, of course. And therefore, as I'm sure we can now realize, this timeless foursquare Spirit of God unfolds to our understanding through those reflecting tones of the synonymous terms for God, which we've been responding to consistently all the way down the triptych center panel. Yes? So we can begin now to see the reason for these reflecting tones of the synonymous terms and how spiritually inevitable they are. Spirit reflecting, being conscious of itself. Because as the Divine Spirit unfolds in this way, it cannot help but disperse the darkness upon the face of the deep things of God and bring to light the glorious fact that the human race has, in reality, spiritual, not material form, and is actually full, therefore not void, of spirituality. No such thing, therefore, in truth, as earth being without form and void, as postulated in Genesis 1-2. And this absolute reality of the Spirit of God good, revealing the absolute unreality of the spirit of evil, seen initially in the mythology of the fallen Lucifer, you remember, is none other than the original monotheism of the children of Israel in the Old Testament, reaching its logical conclusion in the revelation of Christian science in the sixth millennium as the eternal divine science of all the world's being. In terms of actual human history, therefore, around the 1860s, it, of necessity, brings to the surface of consciousness the atheism inherent in Marxian communism, where essentially matter is all and God, spirit is naught, while in Christian science God's spirit is all and matter is naught. Karl Marx thus promulgates his doctrine in his book Das Kapital just a few years before Mary Baker Eddy in the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health, puts before the world the teachings of Christian Science. The purpose of Christian Science being thus to render understandable to humanity the eternal unity of God and man, its recorded statement had necessarily to be based from the beginning on certain capitalized, synonymous terms for the infinite, because without this differentiation and integration of ideas of God, a scientific understanding of the cosmos itself would be logically impossible. What Christian Science is concerned with, therefore, in practice, we see, is the idea of man's infinite, unexpendable capital resources, in contrast to the theories of material economics expounded in Das Kapital, as well as in the limited beliefs of Western capitalism generally. Now, the founding career of Mary Baker Eddy we shall, of course, be examining in detail when we turn to the left-hand wing of the triptych chart. You see that, don't you? Suffice it for the moment to observe that in addition to stating the divine principle of Christian Science in the textbook, what Mrs. Eddy also does is to illustrate the workings of this principle in practical human experience by founding a religious church organization. This organization, consisting of a central autocratic mother church together with a worldwide family of branch churches. The mother's purpose being to lead these branches as her children, step by step, to the status of individual independence and self-government under God alone. And it's this very independence which Mrs. Eddy likens to the time when, as we were discussing a moment ago, the American colonies of the mother country Britain declared their independence from an outside ruling maternal authority. Like our nation, she says, Christian Science has its declaration of independence. God has endowed man with inalienable rights, among which are self-government, reason, and conscience. We see the parallel, don't we? So let's note how, in response to this underlying principle of mature self-government, Britain's vast and unique colonial empire came little by little to be translated into a commonwealth of self-governing nations, each having sovereign dominion status. Because this, we now see in retrospect, was the mother's intentions in Christian Science regarding her family of branch churches once she'd led them to this point of individual spiritual responsibility. When at last, therefore, Mary Baker Eddy's leadership yields to that of her successor, whom she declares in 1901 will be none other than man, the generic term for mankind, there is destined gradually to be set up on earth the New Jerusalem, or foursquare civilization itself, based on the divine principle love and showing forth the universal brotherhood of man, what Paul calls the Jerusalem above, which is free, which is the mother of us all. But such a happening can only take place if the divine provisions left in the written instructions of Mary Baker Eddy are put into practice and obeyed. And this is not what happens humanly when her mission terminates in 1910 and we enter upon the final tone of the sixth period, truth in its aspect as love. In other words, her church officers fail to implement her God-given instructions, and instead of mankind inheriting an era of world peace, Jerusalem, city of peace, a prolonged period of world war ensues, accompanied by untold human suffering. Now, this is the era, as we know, determined by truth in its aspect as love, that takes us to the close of the present 20th century and therefore of the present sixth millennium of the civilization movement. And of course, it's the era which we shall examine in some detail when, in due course, we embark on the triptych's right-hand wing, and at its close, find ourselves standing on the threshold of the seventh millennium itself. Suffice it to say at this moment, therefore, that despite the disobedience unwittingly perpetrated by the church organization regarding its leaders' stated instructions, and despite the repercussions this apparently had on the world at large, the salvation of the human race cannot, in fact, be held back and thwarted. And therefore, what amounts to being the comprehensible science and system held within the depths of the Christian Science textbook has over the years in this truth as love era been bringing itself step by step to light, accompanied necessarily by the steady decline of the church in Boston. In order that what Christian Science truly is, as the church universal and triumphant, the actual body of Christ itself, the worldwide structure of truth and love, may be understood at this present time with sufficient clarity and scientific accuracy to open the door to its actual recognition and acceptance on an increasing world scale in the course of the coming epoch of the seventh millennium. Now, we do realize that, don't we? So here for the moment, let's leave our present brief survey of the seven tones of the synonym truth as they determine and unfold the story of the world embracing Western civilization. And glance at the last column of all, where the civilization of the holy city itself is represented as unfolding its spiritual purpose. That's to say, where the creative word in its aspect as Christianity, what I, God, am as the body of the individual spiritual identities that make up the truth of the whole living world, changes finally to the word as science, or to where it is revealing what infinity actually is in the fullness of its impartial, everywhere available divine science. We see that, don't we, signified in the seventh column. All right then, having looked at the different columns vertically, as it were, each in the tones of truth as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, let's turn now, as is our custom, tone by tone, to the flow of the sequences horizontally. That's to say, first the signification of truth as mind across the different columns, and the same with all the other tones up to the point of truth as love, the last one. Agreed? Wonderful. Let's do it then. And please let's take it all just as simply and easily as ever we can, realizing that what it all stands for spiritually is already ours by divine decree, by divine inheritance, and therefore that it pertains to our present consciousness of reality here and now. The first column then. Truth is mind. Signifies, doesn't it, the very presence of our own true mind, the one Christ mind, the source and origin of our manhood and womanhood as the image and likeness of the Father, Mother, God. Truth as mind, yes? Which in the second column, the column of the actual sixth day of creation, is where all the diversified, classified, individualized thoughts of God that make up what we man truly are, remain forever in and of God as their source, and are as eternal, therefore, as the mind, conceiving them, as says the text. That's clear. And this, of course, is the divine reality of all those animal qualities and thoughts summed up under the heading of the beguiling, talking serpent in the third column that hypnotizes Adam and Eve and is cursed to eat the dust of the earth or to return to the nothingness from whence it came. Which is truth saying to this most subtle of all the beasts of the field which the Lord God had made, dust nothingness thou art, and unto dust nothingness shalt thou return. The antithesis of truth as mind. How wonderful, therefore, that what we see in this tone of truth as mind in the fourth column, the Jesus column, is the Christ man himself, fully resurrected above all such death-dealing animalistic confines and appearing truly as the new world man. What all of us truly are in our divine reality, isn't it? And that which is represented then in counterfeit symbolic form in the civilization column by the emergence out of the dark womb, tomb, confines of the early Middle Ages of the new Western Christian society that is likewise to typify the new world man, man in the universal generic sense, gradually promoting freedom and self-government above organic limits to the whole human race. And therefore in this tone of truth as mind are to be seen the seed-like beginnings of all that Western society properly represents, namely the mother, the woman in the apocalypse, bringing to birth Christian science, or man in the image of God. But this, of course, is the spiritual translation of the historical concept, isn't it? Not the depiction furnished by the corporeal senses. And yet, of course, the divine reality is, must be, in underlying control of all that the corporeal senses depict. And all of this, the work fundamentally of the Word of God in its aspect as Christianity in the last column, or as the real spiritual body of mankind. On then to truth in its aspect as spirit, or to what it is, first column, that actually constitutes the image and likeness of God. The substance out of which man's actual nature and character is formed, and whereof it is born. And we find this actually specified in the second tone of the sixth day of creation, the second column, where it is revealed as the truth about all those lesser ideas of God, the range of the so-called creatures of God's creation, which in their sum total constitute man every whit whole. Because the word whit is from the same root, isn't it, as the word creature. And therefore these constituent elements or ideas are called in the text qualities of thought, God's thoughts, and said to be spiritual realities. And these thoughts, we are shown, are basically the qualities of the little child. And a little child shall lead them. A little child is always so close, isn't he, to the true idea of the animals. Children nearly always love animals. And therefore it is the state of thought of the little child, evolving towards manhood, who leads man forward to the next tone, truth as soul, where he perceives himself in actual maturity as the son of the Father, Mother, God. How different, therefore, from what we find in the third column regarding this tone of truth as spirit, where Eve is cursed to bring forth in sorrow what the glossary under the heading of children defines negatively as sensual and mortal belief, counterfeits of creation, the opposite of God's thoughts, not in embryo but in maturity, which is the corresponding positive definition of children there in the glossary. Whereas in the fourth column, the Jesus column, man is most certainly in maturity and not in embryo, because here he's fully born again. Born not of Eve, but of the matrix of the motherhood of God. Hence resurrected above all that Mother Eve represents with her emphasis on man born of the flesh. To Jesus, therefore, the womb-tomb cycle of mortality is no more. Because man is now wholly the product of the Father, Mother, God. Hence what we have symbolically in the civilization column is the renaissance of Western civilized scientific man, known as his rebirth of learning. Because here, Western man, typical in a counterfeit symbolic sense, of course, of generic man, is literally in process of being born again, resurrected from that dark state of intellectual stagnation from which, as the offspring of Adam and Eve, he would seem to have come. And all because once again the Word of God, in its aspect of birth-giving Christianity, is everywhere making its impact on world thought according to the seventh column. Inevitably, therefore, in the tone of truth as soul, we arrive at the actuality of man's spiritual identity. Man, the embodiment of all the manhood and womanhood qualities of spirit which we were shown in the previous tone. Hence, at this point in the sixth day of creation, second column, man is truly seen as the image and likeness of God, having total dominion over his own constitution. But of course, it's been man appearing ever since the first dawning of the light in the first day of creation, hasn't it? Yet this is the first time his orderly evolution has appeared in the fullness of his identity, every whit whole. It's as if up to this point the accent has been on the objective approach to what he is. Now the objective is seen to be subjective, and this is what accounts for his dominion over all the earth. Because here, in the maturity of his manhood and womanhood, he has dominion over himself, both objectively and subjectively. Which means that by reason of the dynamics of truth as soul, he has dominion over his entire body of consciousness. But the materially minded Adam in the third column has no such dominion. Rather, he is cursed now to till the ground outside of himself, or as that which is objective to his own being. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, truth of soul tells him, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. That man is mortal is thus a complete nothingness, a lie. While that he is immortal is, of course, scientific truth. How comforting, therefore, that in the Jesus column, the fourth column, although the risen Christ man still looks to the senses of Mary Magdalene as if he's a gardener like Adam, nevertheless, she is soon to realize through her spiritual senses that what confronts her now is man himself in his immortal reality, never born, never dying, but coexistent with the Father, Mother, God, man having by reflection the form of God, and therefore to human sense, man reformed. How natural then that in the civilization column the symbol should appear of Western scientific man freeing himself from Roman domination through the agency of his Protestant Reformation. The apparent reformation or resurrection, that is, of his spiritually free and unconfined identity. So that in the last column, what God the Word in his manifestation as universal Christianity is in process of working out for mankind is the problem of organic, dictatorial, ecclesiastical restrictions as typified by the Church of Rome. Which brings us to the tone of truth as principle, doesn't it? Or to man in column one under the government of his divine principle alone. And this in the day of creation in the second column is man in the ideal wholeness of his manhood and womanhood, spiritually self-governed, because governed by impartial, infallible principle. Man absolutely incapable, therefore, of being removed from this principle's ever-presence. But Adam and Eve in the third column, because they've listened to the voice of the serpent instead of to the voice of God, are as mortals cast out of the divine presence. They've really cut themselves off from the Garden of Eden, their paradise, which means, metaphysically speaking, that they've lost control over their bodies. In the words of the text at this point, this is simply error excluding itself from health and harmony, and therefore leaving man as he really is, one with God, as taught throughout the scriptures. And therefore what the resurrected Jesus must do in the fourth column is, on the walk to Emmaus, to expound to his disciples in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. That's to say, he must explain to them that never has man, as the Son of God, been severed from his unity with the Father, Mother, God. This being the scientific fact of man's experience, which Jesus himself has now proved to be true, both divinely and humanly. Hence the need for Christian science to come that all mankind may begin to prove this also. In the civilization column, therefore, the way towards this goal starts to be prepared when the Pilgrim Fathers separate themselves from the old world of Europe and take up residence in the new world of America. And what is it that inspires them on their way? By the new authorized version of the Bible, expounding the principle of man's forever inseparability from God, and therefore his spiritual freedom under God. The pilgrims, you see, weren't like Adam and Eve cast out of God's presence and cast into an alien land. They'd really cast out of their own presence the injustices and restrictions, political and religious, that otherwise would keep them from God's presence. Hence their entrance literally into a completely new, freedom-oriented land. Therefore, in the last column, the Word of God, as expounded in the Bible, continues in its aspect as Christianity to lead towards the eventual new realm of its own original and ultimate science. You really can see this coming, can't you? From truth as principle, then, we move to truth as life, where nothing can now stop us from multiplying fruitfully our dominion over our environment, from replenishing spiritually and subduing the false sense of it. Column one thus points to this idea of Christly multiplication, and column two, as you see, to the way this multiplying dominion is portrayed particularly in the sixth day of creation. But this isn't the kind of multiplication being practiced by Adam and Eve in the third column, is it? Who are in process now of multiplying their own mortality in the shape of Cain and Abel. They're really diminishing their sense of life instead of increasing it, because this sense of multiplication is soon to result in murder and death. Whereas multiplication in the case of Jesus in the fourth column takes the form of his being everywhere present instantaneously throughout space and time. A divine idea, like a mathematical idea, doesn't have to move through time to get from one place to another, does it? Hence walls and doors are no longer a barrier to the now fully resurrected Jesus. Instantly and unobstructed, he stands in the midst of the disciples, wherever they are, and bids them be at peace. This is because clearly the human symbol, under the control of the idea it symbolizes, is just as much ever-present as is the idea itself. The divine idea reproduces the symbol that reflects and represents it whenever and wherever the symbol itself is needed. And so the many world revolutionary movements that appear at this time on the historical stage in the civilization column are all for the purpose of multiplying humanity's dominion over its own living conditions. The Industrial Revolution, for example, through the invention of its labor-saving machines, vastly increases men's capital resources at the same time as multiplying their applied scientific technologies. The purpose, materially speaking, of the Industrial Revolution is clearly to replenish the earth and subdue it. When, therefore, through the American Revolution, Britain's American colonies throw off the yoke of a restrictive mother country, this launches into being a nation whose potential to multiply its power, its resources, and its influence generally seems to know no bounds. The note, you see, that requires to be sounded at this point of truth as life is that of the union of all things under the authority of God and as the criterion of an ever more fruitful and abundant life. And this is indeed what happens in the case of the individual American states as the result of her civil war. The states become welded into a single federal union, just as the Western society as a whole, through its impartial and impersonal physical sciences, has by this time succeeded in uniting the civilized world into a single westernized entity. And what this implies in the last column is that the word in its aspect as Christianity has now carried out its purpose with regard to the unitary Christ body, and therefore that the tone can now change to the word as science. You see that being represented there in the seventh column, don't you? So the stage, having now been set for Christian science to come and bestow upon the human race its longed for dominion over itself and its environment, which the West's physical sciences will never be able to do, the great climactic standpoint of truth, purely in its own aspect as truth, has been reached and now dominates the scene. In column one, then, this idea of the science of the whole world's being, or truth absolutely as truth. And in the sixth day of creation in column two, the voice of this science saying to all mankind, behold, I have given you. I have given you to understand and assimilate that which in fact you everlastingly are, namely, universal Christian science. Bring this science forth out of your own spiritual loins, because it's the truth of your own imperishable being. It's there alone that it is to be found. In other words, what I have bestowed upon you is the means of your being one grand spiritual brotherhood, all having the same principle or father, and blessed is that man who seeth his brother's need and supplieth it, seeking his own in another's good. But instead of this assistance in brotherhood being manifest in the story of Adam in the third column, instead of the rich in spirit helping the poor in one grand brotherhood, Cain, for reasons of jealousy and greed, and the belief that he's got something over there which I haven't got over here, and I want it for myself, rises up against his brother Abel and slays him. Precisely the antithesis of what happens in the Jesus story at this point, where, being richly endowed himself with the Bible, spiritual and scientific meaning, Jesus, it is said, opens his disciples' understanding that they too might understand the scriptures. Because in spiritually understanding the scriptures, men understand and practice the divine principle love. Therefore they understand and love one another as this principle's own self-expression, and do not malpractice upon and murder one another, either physically or mentally. They know that as God's reflection, they already have by reflection all that God himself has and is, and this is true for all mankind. And therefore, what God has at this point given to mankind is science and health with key to the scriptures. And therefore, through the actual advent of Christian science and its textbook Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, which appears historically in the civilization story at this point, this true idea of the universal brotherhood of man comes as the spiritual answer to that which accompanies its appearing, namely the advent of communistic atheism. Because in purporting to bring about the brotherhood of man on materialistic foundations, communism, through its belief in class rivalry and economic deprivation, cannot help but involve brother murdering brother in the same way that Cain murders Abel. Yet by the time the sixth millennium closes, which is actually happening in our experience today, what we're in process of witnessing, isn't it so, is the remarkable speed of the demise of this atheistic doctrine due to the underlying reality of the divine science of man, whether at present this is realized or not. So now you see what takes place on the triptych at this point. So imperative is it for us to understand the workings of the second Christly advent in its relationship to the first, that this truth as truth tone is, as you see, expanded outwards to form the left-hand wing of the structure as a whole, just as subsequently the tone of truth as love is likewise expanded and extended to form the right-hand wing. Well, we are well aware of that now, aren't we? Because without what these two wings stand for, namely the comprehensible science and system of the whole world's being. We would have no scientific understanding of the way in which, under their original, timeless, divine impulsion, this world of ours has, humanly and historically speaking, been moving steadily forward, millennium by millennium, towards the fullness of their meaning as its own world-saving goal. Now, this is the way we've been following, isn't it, step by step through the days of creation, until in these two tones of truth as truth and truth as love, which close the sixth period, that which has been determining the journey all the way along openly reveals itself, and we begin to understand spiritually the real meaning of the universe in which we forever live. And therefore it isn't too much, is it, to conclude that what is being represented are the two wings of the great eagle of Revelation 12 that literally fly the eagle itself forward until in the end, in an equivalent of the seventh day of creation, the eagle itself comes serenely to rest, and its two wings, having accomplished their initial God-appointed purpose, fold back into the body of the eagle itself. All of which is simple, of course, so don't make more of it than you feel is justified. But it's nice, perhaps, to remember how the actual bird, the eagle, is the emblem of the Gospel of John, the fourth gospel, the science gospel, and how with superlative keenness of vision, the eagle flies higher than any other bird. It's also the emblem of the United States of America, which in its relation to Great Britain, in Mrs. Eddy's poem, returns to bless a bridal betokened from above, she says. Anyway, what we're going to do now is begin to have an inspiring and most necessary time focusing our thought on the left-hand wing or panel as a whole, as it tells the story of Mary Baker Eddy's founding mission from 1866 to 1910 in the main tone of truth as truth, and the way in which through her mission God says in effect to humanity, "Behold, I have given you Christian Science. Take its textbook, Science and Health, take it and eat it up as the means of your spiritual salvation." Or in parallel with what we've seen Jesus doing at this point, "I have given you in this book the key to the divine science of the Scriptures. Open your understanding and assimilate its meaning, not as something coming to you from outside, but as coming to you from deep down within your own innermost being." And therefore, as Mrs. Eddy says of her wonderful discovery, "It was the gift of the grace of God given unto me by the effectual working of his power." So now, the left-hand wing or panel itself, which as you see, is divided for convenience into four main columns, isn't it? Even as the right-hand panel is when we come to that later on. But remember that because all divine revelation, irrespective of any particular time scale, unfolds in the order of the 7 days of creation, therefore the Founder's own mission from 1866 to 1910 conforms necessarily to the pattern of the center panel itself, or to the structure of these same 7 days and their corresponding 7,000-year periods. And of course, it will be the same in the case of the revelation of the absolute science of Christian Science that comes welling up out of all that the Founder has bequeathed to the world, and which will be shown as coming to light in the right-hand panel. This too necessarily conforms to the pattern of these same impersonal 7 days of creation as the scientific measuring rod of the principle of divine science, irrespective, as I say, of any particular time scale. Now, do we know what form this equivalent of the 7 days of creation takes in respect of Mary Baker Eddy's mission? It comes to light in that first column of the left-hand panel, which, as you see, is devoted to the most basic factor of the entire revelation, the evolution of the textbook Science and Health. So do you see how the light of the world dawned once again when this book was first published in 1875, parallel in the center panel with the birth of Jesus, and as an equivalent, therefore, of the first day of creation, let there be light. And the same let there be light will apply, of course, to the idea of non-sectarian science and system when we move to the opening phase of the right-hand panel. But the book itself had necessarily to evolve through a series of essential revisions. And it's these revisions which, as they come forth over the years, determine the parallel with the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh days of creation. Now you will follow all this on the chart very easily. At the point of the book's seventh evolutionary phase from 1907 to 1910, do you see it? There it can be said that the textbook is finished, that as far as its recorded statement is concerned, the divine principle has fully revealed itself, and the revelation itself is at rest. Not that the revisions are for the purpose of correcting mistakes, inaccuracies, errors of statement made in the first edition. The revisions were necessary, the author tells us, only to give a clearer and fuller expression to the book's original meaning. Thus, in 1878, as you see there, came a second edition, and this was the book's first revision. Though the completion of the revision included the book's third edition, published in 1881. And this means that this first revision corresponded to the second day of creation, let there be a firmament, following the original let there be light, and corresponded also, therefore, to the second thousand-year period, which biblically is the story of Noah and his ark. Remarkable, therefore, or isn't it, that when this second edition appeared in 1878, it had embossed on its outside cover an ark surmounting turbulent waters. Then in 1883 came the book's sixth edition, and this was its second major revision. Now, can you follow the revisions and their respective editions there in that first column? I do hope it's clear. Anyway, one of the principal features of this second revision appearing as the book's sixth edition was the addition of a glossary in the form of a second part to the book itself called Key to the Scriptures. Now there I see this first side of tape 6 is coming to an end, and so we turn the tape over at this point and continue without a break on side 2.